This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country and join their calls for justice. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
I just want to know if you also have that, the like drum and bass song that the little Irish children have done on TikTok in your head. And from the look on your face, you're too old to even
know. I only go on TikTok to post clips of my incredible comedy. I don't actually watch videos. Yeah.
If Mike leaves this in, if anyone's listening, they will know exactly what I mean, because there's like this song that's gone very viral. It's like these Irish school kids, and they made this song, I guess, for school. And it's like, think you can stop what we do? I doubt it. And their accents just sound so, and it's so catchy. I'm just like walking around the house being like, I doubt it. I got the energy. I'll tell you all about it. Terrible Irish accent. I don't know. No, Irish people, don't write in.
I think you've absolutely nailed it. And I think Mike should put in the actual song now so we could compare and contrast.
Yeah. Think you can stop what we do? I doubt it. We've got the energy. We'll tell you all about it. I searched for my spark and I found it.
Everybody in the crowd start bouncing. Think you can stop what we do? I doubt it. Oh, to be sure. Check it out. Emerald Moon, are you working class, middle class? Are you middle class like myself and Kate Blanchett? How do you identify class-wise?
Well, all that matters is how you identify, as we'll soon find out. That's a good question. I think because I'm paid very well and I'm a manager, maybe middle class.
Oh, yes. And you're a class traitor in that respect, because you would have said that you grew up in a working class household?
Yeah. I'm definitely more middle class than my parents. Yeah. Well, that's for sure.
Well, there you go. That's social mobility under the
true.
Albanese Labor
government.
Capitalism
works, baby. I worked hard and I got here.
You did. Yes, I did. You didn't get any handouts, did you, either?
No.
At the Cannes Film Festival, Kate Blanchett was quoted as saying, I'm white, I'm privileged, I'm middle class, and I think, you know, one can be accused of having a bit of a white savior complex. But to be perfectly honest, my interaction with refugees in the field and also in resettled environments has totally changed my perspective on the world. This caused outrage because Kate Blanchett is super, super rich and is a big Hollywood star, and she called herself middle class.
That's what that is.
It's like, what the hell? Now, what do you think about this? I think it's a silly thing for her to say.
Is it a silly thing for her to say? Because, I hadn't read or heard the actual quote. And now I see the quote. I'm like, that's so cool.
I'm saying this in context. I love Kate Blanchett. I think she's an extraordinary actor, like an incredible artist. Mm. And I think in terms of massive celebrities, like her level of A-list and her willingness to still get involved in political stuff, I think is quite admirable. I think she's also done as much as celebrity culture can kind of do to funnel attention and resources to help people desperately in need. So I'm very, very much in favor of Kate Blanchett. Mm. I also think she had to say middle class because she probably just can't say, I'm super rich.
But she clearly meant, like in the context of that line, she clearly meant it as I'm rich. She meant, she used middle class to mean wealthy.
Yes.
Don't you think? In the context where she's saying, I'm white, I'm privileged, I'm middle class.
Yes. Yes, and she's putting that all in the context of she's aware of the fraught white savior complex involved getting involved in refugee issues particularly. And, you know, I think the subtext here is also the context of Gaza and speaking out in support of Palestine. So, yes, it's an admirable sentiment. But, you know, people on the internet said, what, Kate Blanchett's middle class? That's insane. She's got hundreds of millions of dollars. That's fucking bullshit.
Yeah, sure.
Van Badham.
If only there were a definitive take from an experienced political commentator to settle this for us. Tom, is there anyone?
Well, my good friend Van Badham.
Who is your good friend? Never forget that Tom interviewed Van Badham because he loves her and he thinks that all her opinions are correct.
She still hasn't blocked me on Threads, so I occasionally still get an insight into the Badham world via Threads. And I listen to a podcast.
What do you mean?
Just sometimes. Kate Blanchett was pilloried for saying she's middle class. Here's why she's right on the money, in Australia at least. This is an opinion piece from Van Badham in The Guardian, basically defending Kate Blanchett's use of the term middle class.
Okay. And so Van and I are on the same side.
I guess, yes, you love her and agree and want to kiss her. What Americans understand is the middle class is measured in terms of wealth, writes Van. Back in Australia, however, our analysis of class is inherited from our British colonisers. Unlike the United States, here class is understood as an intersection of the sociological forces of which hard capital is indeed a part, but social capital is paramount. Here, as in Britain, class is expressed not in raw dollar amounts, but individually and collectively in attitudes, perceptible entitlements, proximity to cultural opportunity, and performance codes ranging from speech to social habits.
None of the above is what class actually is in terms of class theory, class analysis. But, okay, go on.
The notorious class hierarchy of British accents is one code, for example, in Australia, where blue-collar tradies earn $100,000 annual salaries, but an award-wage barista might speak down to you as if you've just farted out loud at a rowing club dinner. Private education has emerged as a real class clanger. Can't help but read that with, like, a subtweet of Ed, like, hanging some shit on a local barista in her area that's clearly shown her some shade.
Someone was rude to her. Someone recognised her from the internet. Go on. Tell
me. We acknowledge these codes wordlessly, intuitively, and people could read the piece for themselves if they like. Intuitively, often unconsciously in our interactions, but we tend to defer to or antagonize those of cultural similarities, separateness to our class experience when we do. The dollars, darling, do not come into it.
The dollars, darling, do not come into it. I love it when Van calls me darling via darling. Her opinion pieces. What Van is basically saying is that in Australia, class is a vibe. which is maybe true, like the popular conception of class.
Yes.
How we use it probably is like it's a vibe, which is why we can have such a, you know, outraged but also divorced from reality or technical definitions of term class discourse around Cate Blanchett's statement, because people are just like, well, that doesn't feel like that's not the right vibe.
Yep. Yes, and I think you could definitely agree, and I think Van is making this broader point, that our concepts of class is like a total mess, right? And she points to the fact that in polls, something like 70% of people identify themselves as middle class. People like to think of themselves as middle class, or at least they or working class, you know. They're very happy to identify in that respect. And it is very true. The questions of class have been almost completely divorced from their relationship to production, our relationship to production, or indeed, you know, material questions of wealth and assets.
Yeah, I was looking at the ANU election study. The reason that came up is because that was one of the last times we talked about class distinctions on the podcast. It was when we were talking about the election study. And I was like, oh, how did they determine class? Because they have questions around class and voting, et cetera. And it was just purely self-identification, in which 41% of voters identify themselves as working class, 48% identify as middle class, and 2% identify as upper class. so I thought that was interesting.
They should give the ruling class option to go, yeah, I'm ruling class.
Yeah, I identify as ruling class.
So, I mean, yes, and I know that you've noted here that, of course, if you brought a Marxist perspective to this, the idea of class is your relationship to production, right?
It's much clearer. Like, it's not just vibe. There's a clear, you know, in terms of, the classic conception of class theory, you would have the bourgeoisie and you would have, well, classically you would have landholders, landlords, and then you would have the proletariat, the workers. But then there comes into it the petty bourgeois, like petty bourgeoisie. I don't know. I don't fucking speak French. don't tell me. Don't ask me how to say it. Don't ask me how to spell it. Yep. But like even now, if you were to speak about class in a paper or like in terms of theory around class, you would have the working class where you sell your labor to live. Then you would have the middle class, which is like the petty bourgeois who have productive capital and they exploit others' labor to live, but usually on like a smaller scale. So like small and medium business owners, probably also landlords, and also now used to include like managers and professionals, highly paid professionals, doctors, lawyers, whatever. And then you have the upper class, who are the bourgeoisie, who own the means of production traditionally. Mm. They make their money from that, from exploiting their capital that they have and other people's labor. And that would mean like the big banks, you know, multinational mining corporations, or people like Gina Rinehart, like the people who own the really big capital. And that doesn't include, that's not Cate Blanchett, right? Like, I mean, in theory, she sells her labor. She probably also has like investments and shit as well. I don't know.
She owns heaps of property in Australia or the UK.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So she probably makes a lot of money from property. But I'm like, what do you say her worth was? Even hundreds of millions. That doesn't necessarily mean that you are upper class bourgeoisie, like that you are the holder of big capital. that's not her relationship to capital. You know what I mean? Like, that's not her primary way of interacting with the economy.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, her net worth is estimated about $140 million. I mean, I also think Van in an article sort of says, you know, private education has been the big indicator. I mean, Kate Blanchett was born to a property developer and a teacher, and her father was a United States Navy chief petty officer who became an advertising executive. She went to Ivanhoe Girls Grammar School and then MLC. Yeah.
Don't you think that's like thoroughly upper middle class, right? Yeah, like, yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's not as though she was born, you know, it's not as though she inherited, I don't know, like a multinational corporation or, I don't know, a massive portfolio of property spanning, you know what I mean? Like, that's
She's a freak, you know. Occasionally under capitalism, particularly in the arts, you get these freaks. Someone who, she had to sell her labor to make a living, Kate Blanchett, as a working artist, as a jobbing actor, then happened to hit it big time and amassed huge amounts of capital. She now owns property. She doesn't need to work for the rest of her life. I think that's also an important factor. Like, again, if we say if working class.
She doesn't now need to sell her labor to live, which is why, I mean, she's not working class.
Certainly not working class, nor ever was going to be. But I mean, yes, if you have the expansive definition of working class, that is you need to work to live, there are lots of people who live a very nice life, a very comfortable life, who if they stopped working would still find themselves in, you know, pretty financial problem. As
I mean, if I stopped working, obviously I'd be fucked. But
So that, which is why, our concept of a worker might be a lot broader than we actually think, or what it means to be part of the broader, broadly defined working class. It means a lot of people, because I think the majority of people find themselves in that position. They need to keep earning a salary or wage in order to survive.
Yeah, which is why the Marxist definition is kind of simpler, because it's like, well, I'm clearly not bourgeois in any meaning of the term. Like, I'm not bourgeois and I'm not petty bourgeois because I don't make money from owning capital. You know what I mean? So then I'm a proletariat. Like, that's pretty simple.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting to interrogate how our definitions of class can be disconnected from the ideas of rich and poor, right? I mean, you can be working class and still be doing very well, as Van points out in her article. You know, obviously, if you're in the trades, a traditionally what we perceive to be a working class job can be earning
cashed
very
up
good
bogans,
wage,
Tom.
Indeed. Fucking cashed up bogans and shit. Mm.
Yeah,
I would direct
that's what
people
I mean. Maybe she should have. That's the thing. If people are taking middle class to mean median wage, then yes, obviously, Kate Blanchett is wrong.
Right, which I think is a very common perception that these classes are basically income bands, and that if you earn up to this much money, then you're working class. Yeah. Over that, then you're middle class. Right. Now, again, we think that's less sophisticated, and I think there was a really good piece in The Conversation by Rose Butler that I think is kind of giving Van's perspective some credit. That is, there are cultural and aesthetic cultural signifiers that we take into factor in the common understanding of class. But if we're actually seriously talking about class under capitalism, we should ignore those. And it might be nice for Van to sort of at least bring some critique to the fact that Kate Blanchett is, even though she's fantastic and she looks incredible, is hoarding shitloads of wealth and should be taxed significantly to make other people's lives better.
And do you think that the dress, like, that she wore that was people like, is it a Palestinian flag, even though she didn't comment? And then it turned out like the part that looked white was actually pale pink, but then some people were like, well, maybe it was intentionally pale pink because she knew that on the red carpet that would look white. Like, what do you think? Was it a Palestinian flag or not?
Well, according to Van's article, The Guardian has exposed the fact that's not true, but then in other places.
But only because she was like, yeah, but it's pale pink. I read that article. I'm like, yeah, but she still hasn't confirmed or denied.
She's been upfront in joining global calls for peace and a ceasefire in Gaza. So it's weird for Kate Blanchett to be trying to hide that. Although I did see that Guy Pearce wore a fucking Palestinian flag pin in a photo shoot for Variety and they photoshopped it out. Like,
whoa,
this is
really?
The level of insanity that is kicking around at the moment.
It's wow. Funny. Cool. Good stuff.
Speaking of, I just looked up the archives there, and I've noticed that since October 7th, Van Badham has found the time to write about Kate Blanchett's comments on the red carpet, the Optus outage, and the return of the teenage mullet. And yet somehow
she's
still not said anything about the biggest story in the world, about the genocide that's going on,
and
her beloved Labour Party's complicity.
That is so strange. Well, she probably, I mean, there was a lot of field work and research. I'm sure I had to go into the teenage mullet piece, so you can understand she wouldn't have had the time.
Well, the Greens have become a bigoted party. It's Marxism masquerading as environmentalism. That party has deviated from its initial path on environmental policy to now being a party that is promoting un-Australian values. And to see the behaviour of its leader and the failure to condemn with vigour the attacks on October the 7th and failure to really call out and stamp out anti-Semitism in Australia since October the 7th makes the Greens, you know, a very dangerous party in my view today.
Frankly, I've always found the Greens to be a real serious danger to Australia.
Serious danger to Australia.
Hey, hey, it's your favourite working / middle class podcast, Serious Danger, a podcast about Green politics in Australia. It's not an official Greens Party podcast. Don't listen to the rumours. Made possible with the help of Green Institute and produced by Michael the Griff Griffin. This week, we finally have a very exciting guest. I've wanted this guest to come on for a long time. It is journalist Rachel Withers. You may know her from The Monthly and other good work. She's going to chat what's been happening this week, including, you know, Israel's invasion of Rafah and the political fallout, the furor surrounding Laura Tingle from the ABC and her comments around Australia being a racist country, and the Greens' motion to recognise Palestinian statehood in federal parliament. First, we should thank our new patrons, Jill, Darcy, Carol, Dean, Merrin, and Spotless Mind 86. But then I'm suspicious because, again, I'm pretty sure, unless there's another Merrin out there who's a Patreon subscriber, and I'm sorry if there is, but I assume Merrin is my mum.
Oh.
Who I thought was already a patron. Maybe she unsubscribed and came back. I don't know. But maybe it was just a renewal. Who knows? I feel like sometimes
I'm sure she came back to listen to us reading chapter 4 of Patty Manning's Inside the Greens. That's this week's Patreon episode, the tome that is Patty Manning's Inside the Greens. Some wonderful reviews and feedback on this reading series. This is from patron Peter. I don't know what's happened to my mind, but I actually enjoy these readings.
I praise Stump.
Thanks, Peter.
I'm enjoying them too.
I love them.
This is right. Like, you know, I talk a little bit of shit about them and how slow we're getting through the book, but they're fun. There's like, I don't know, it's an interesting little retrospective into the origins of the Greens and reminding me, giving us little youngins, particularly me, because I'm quite young. Not you, Tom, you're over 30. I'm still under. But, you know, a bit of a history lesson.
Yeah, it's so weird having lived through these events to then
Yeah,
I was there to then read it in the book form. Chapter 4 was Getting Together. It's about the uniting of the federal party and the very messy process and questions about prescribing certain socialists and the conflicts again between more conservative conservationists and the bloody Trotskyists. It's all good stuff. So please have a listen to that. Sign up. Mm-hmm. Also, thanks to patron Electra, who sent us a message. Hey, loved your recent episode with Trina Massey in Brisbane. She's amazing. Agree. True. I'd love to see some episodes featuring some federal candidates if they'd be willing to feature on the podcast. I'm thinking guests like Sonia Semmons for McNamara. Electra wants to hear about Sonia campaigning in McNamara. I think they just had their launch last weekend, actually, for that campaign. But they're probably first of many. I think you have heaps of launches when you want a lot of energy around a campaign. Particularly about, you know, campaigning in McNamara, which has a large Jewish community. The issues surrounding Israel-Palestine, very spicy in that particular electorate. The Jewish Greens, I think, it'd be interesting to talk to some folks in the Jewish Greens at some point too about how they're navigating the current status quo and how Sonia relates to that. Electra also suggested having Mandy Nolan on, Sophie Greer for Perth. Oh, yeah. I don't know much about Perth at all. Katie McCusker has just been selected for the federal seat of Sturt. She was running in the Dunstan by-election and did pretty bloody well.
Okay.
There's actually a real chance the Greens could win these seats, if not this election, at least the one after. Anyway, I'm sure you're planning to do more ups with federal candidates. Anyway, in the lead up to election, just wanted to share some thoughts. Keep doing what you're doing. Love the podcast.
Yes, is the answer. I would like to have more great people on. There's going to be, soon enough, we're going to have federal candidates coming out our ears and there's lots of pre-selections happening. So, yeah, we should do that.
Melbourne. She has a thirst for knowledge. She stood acting at NIDA. Just what I
got an eye. All right, just quickly before we have a chat to the wonderful Rachel Withers, I thought it'd be worth checking in on the continuing migration shit show, xenophobia central, that is Australia And this shit keeps coming up and keeps playing out in federal politics.
How dare you say Australia is xenophobic? You should be sanctioned.
I'm sorry.
Even a stern sorry.
To. Oh, no, I'm going to get fired from the ABC.
From the ABC.
I'm actually going to tape an ABC show later today. Hopefully, yeah, this will come out after that's happened.
Sizzle. So
that'll
be able to
remember. Okay. Sizzle. The Coalition has been hounding Labor over revelations that non-citizens who have committed crimes and served their jail terms have had the ministerial cancellations of their visas overturned after a policy change by the Albanese government. The initial change, made after the New Zealand government requested that its citizens with long associations to Australia not be deported, emphasised that the strength, nature and duration of their ties to Australia was to be considered in visa decisions. Now, this is sort of an ongoing issue that we've touched before on the show, right? Remember, there's the 501 visa cancellations. You remember when we discussed this on the show, Emma?
Yeah, I actually couldn't – I don't remember this specific conversation and I couldn't find anything in the show notes, so I don't know why I don't remember it and you do, but maybe some listeners do.
Well, I remember it because you said something during that conversation that has stuck with me the whole time that I'll mention it a bit. It was a fantastic piece of Emerald Moon analysis.
Wow. What did I say?
I'll tell you in a bit. Okay. There's a bit of sizzle. But it was these cases, right, of people coming to Australia from mainly New Zealand, also the UK, people who would come to this country as children, sometimes literally as babies. They grow up in Australia. They commit crimes. They serve their time. They come out of prison. And because they're still technically on a visa, because they haven't got citizenship, they're then deported back to either New Zealand or the UK, despite having almost no connection to those countries at all. So they're going back.
Because that'll fix it.
Yeah, that'll fix it. That'll sort it out. It's just classic, you know, get the fuck out of here, Australia. Look at these foreigners that have spent their entire lives in this country. You know, we have no responsibility to them whatsoever. Fuck off. Mm-hmm. It was a big issue between Australia-New Zealand relations. Albanese promised Jacinda Ardern that Australia would address this. They weren't going to get rid of Section 501 deportations entirely. That's Section 501 of the Migration Act. But they said, we're going to issue some new advice to make this problem better. In January of last year, Immigration Minister Andrew Giles issued a new ministerial direction known as Direction 99.
Oh, Direction 99.
Can we get like a little sting in there, please? Griff?
Yeah.
Great. Wow! And Direction 99 is guiding decision makers in the Administrative Appeals Tribunal and Home Affairs to consider people's connections and ties to the community as a primary consideration, not just a secondary one. Okay? Mm-hmm. It's not the only consideration. There are other primary considerations, but basically bumping up the importance and the consideration of that.
Yeah.
That when you're cancelling something, considering cancelling someone's visa, maybe look at the fact that they've lived in this
important.
Country for their entire lives.
Yeah.
So that's the advice that was issued. Since then, there have been a number of cases where offenders who have been convicted of violent or sexual offences, and they are terrible offences, including, you know, the rape of children and stuff, which, you know, we can easily say this is all horrific.
Typically, we condemn.
We condemn. We've always been against such things here at Serious Danger. People have committed those offences. They've had their visa cancellations overturned. Okay, so these cases are coming out, and now Peter Dutton and the Coalition are firing up the xenophobia racism machine and have been losing their fucking minds about it. They've been hammering the government on this in Parliament this week, citing all these cases. Look at this person. They did a terrible thing, and yet you cancel their visa, and then the decision to cancel their visa has been overturned. And this is horrific because this means the Albanese government is making Australians and our communities unsafe by having these people remain in this country. And this is the point you made during the last conversation, right? You said, oh, it's clearly not about community safety because we're happy to send these people to another country with no connections whatsoever and I guess where they can commit crimes in New Zealand. We don't give a fuck. These people are a risk, so send them to another country where they can put other people at risk and we don't give a shit about that.
Yeah, it is a very kind of like nationalistic approach, isn't it, right? Because it's like the idea that the role of our government is purely to protect Australian citizens and no responsibility whatsoever for anything that happens outside of our borders.
Yes.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yes, not a very internationalist approach to a thriving humanity and making sure that if you really think these people are a risk. And the only basis you have for these people being a risk to the community is the fact that they were convicted of a crime, but they served their time. If you have any faith whatsoever in the criminal justice system,
yeah,
you probably
almost,
shouldn't because it sucks.
Yeah.
But it's
almost
like,
as though you fucked up the criminal legal system so badly that you know they're going to come out the other end way more fucked up and more likely to reoffend. But that's a whole lot of, you know, that's the prison system.
Okay. And even if we do believe in rehabilitation within, if we think the criminal justice system can provide some rehabilitation, or at least we believe in rehabilitating people who have come out of the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. do we think that's going to do better in the country where they spent most of their lives?
Yeah, with no community connection.
Or in a place that they don't know anyone? Like, what do you think?
Yes. I mean, there's a wealth of evidence that what you need in order to reintegrate into a community and ideally to not offend again after you've spent time in custody is like community connections at the hub, 100% crucial. So it's, yeah.
Well, maybe all these deported criminals will find connections with other people in the same situation and they've know each other from prison, from Australian prison.
Yeah.
And they'll get together in Auckland and start a new
Just
marketing
Just do all
game,
the stuff that they know that they have in common. Like, oh, crimes.
So it's, so, okay, so these people released, the thing that Labor directed the administrative tribunals to do, right? Mm-hmm. The whole idea to try and address this problem has happened,
mm-hmm.
okay? The coalition go crazy. What does Labor do? Do they defend their policy? Do they explain themselves? Do they stand up for the rights of people? Yes, even the people who've committed crimes.
Have they literally ever?
And try and take on this xenophobic attack? No, they immediately fold like the spineless fucking cowards they are. Their initial response in Parliament was to say, hey, Peter Dutton did this too, and citing the examples of people who released while Peter Dutton was the Home Affairs Minister. Genius. Right. They threw the AAT under the bus as well, this administrative tribunal made up of very boring bureaucrats, and they're saying, oh, they've gone mad. They've all gone woke.
For following the directions that you issued.
You told them to do this, okay? Yeah. And then on Wednesday, Albanese announces a new ministerial direction that community safety be made the primary consideration in visa decisions.
They love this move at the moment.
They love this stuff? To just try and out Dutton, right, as we've discussed.
Well, yes, to out Dutton, like classic, to try and out coalition the coalition. But specifically, they've done this in Queensland recently. You know, I've spoken before, all the fucking shit about quote-unquote youth crime and youth crime crisis. And one of the things that they've done is change the Youth Justice Act so that community safety is like a primary objective, is the primary objective as opposed to, other objectives like protecting the rights of a child, for example. And now the LNP in Queensland are also pushing for community safety to be like the primary sentencing consideration when sentencing children over other considerations. So like this is a narrative that I think seems to be running through a few little political discourse is at the moment then.
Right. Wonderful, tough on crime. Combining both tough on crime and hatred of foreigners into one beautiful Australian mix. Like really, well, it's a fantastic opportunity to bring those two things together.
Yeah. And more annoyingly, you know, conflating like what they don't actually mean community safety though, as we've just discussed. Like what they mean is prioritizing continued custody most of the time, or prioritizing like not having people in the community that we deem to be a threat and who don't belong here, not having them in the community. That's what they mean by community safety. Because if the court prioritizes community safety, then they might still come to the conclusion that well, it'd be far more beneficial for community safety to not push people through the crushing and not rehabilitative criminal legal system and you know, the prison system or detention system. So no, that's not even what prioritizing community safety means.
Yeah. So it's just a complete capitulation again to the xenophobic rights. And I think it's important just to bring up again here, because it seems, okay, this is clearly the strategy for the coalition between now and the election. And apparently Labor's has no interest whatsoever in taking this on, right? It's just absolutely going to try and say, no, we're just as big a cunts as you guys are. We are just as prepared to throw any vulnerable people or anyone that it might, you know, that we consider to be outside our realm of moral or political concern under the bus, and we will jump. Whenever you take this attack, we will absolutely respond immediately and backflip and do whatever the hell you want to do, politically neutralize this thing. Proving that they, A, don't stand for anything, and B, are taking a completely useless approach, because you are never going to be more intense on this stuff than
you're
Dutton
never gonna
is.
Beat them.
If people really, really care about this stuff, they're voting for the right-wing hard man, you fucking idiots.
Yeah, like I think they're like, maybe I can stave off a real kind of turn against us by dampening the issue, by just doing what they say. But they always, like, they are fucking idiots in the coalition, but they'll find a new whatever. What do you call it? Thing to go on about.
And so the alternative is, this is the difficult thing, but I acknowledge it's more difficult. I acknowledge that you will cop hate for this in the context of Australia's fucked media environment, but you need to take this challenge on and actually say something about the fact that we have a responsibility, that our society produces crime rather than it just being individuals making terrible choices that has nothing to do with us, that these people who have find themselves led to these horrible crimes are our responsibility. And we need to take that on, right? Yeah. I've never heard any politician. I mean, I guess occasionally the Greens will say something like this, and we'll argue for a more humane approach to issues of crime. But yeah, you're just never going to see Labor do that at all. Hey?
No, and not even necessarily more humane. I mean, yes, more humane, but also more effective. Yes. But no, you're right. They're not willing to even bother with that conversation. They're too fucking lazy. Like you didn't, as if you didn't get into politics to defend your own politics. I don't know.
Right. Well, they're not actually that lazy because they're really doing everything they can to monitor people who are released from detention. The federal government claims to be using drones to track people released from detention as recent laws imposing ankle bracelets and curfews have been described as unconstitutional. Immigration Minister Andrew Giles on Thursday claimed the federal government is using drone technology to track former immigration detainees who were released back into the community. They're being monitored. There is $250 million that we've invested in supporting our law enforcement agencies that's enabled housing, things please. Like using drones to keep track of these people.
May we please have some housing?
No.
Oh, fucking hell.
We don't have the money. What was that? That just flew over your head there. Sorry, they're going to...
Things are tough for all of us. We're all going to have to tighten the belt.
Oh, now I've just heard that the drone has been tracking the wrong brown man. I'm sorry. That's a...
Whoopsie. Right ethnicity, wrong man.
Upon this news, shout out to David Shoebridge, a Green senator, who said the thing about Labor's race to the bottom with Dutton on cruelty to migrants and multicultural Australia is there is no bottom. You just keep on plunging Australia into an abyss. Fucking Whee! Drones.
When will they learn? Our guest this week is the person that we have decided is the only good Australian journalist, maybe over the age of 16, because, you know, Leah Lucy is pretty good. It's Rachel Withers. Welcome.
Yay. Thank you. I mean, I'm so thrilled to be put in the same category as Leo. That's an honour.
High honour. That's
you
true.
You've got to join Six News. You got to get in there.
Rename the Walkleys to the Bleasies.
Six News, but...
Now, we say you're the only good journalist, and obviously, you know, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I think Everald and I have admired your writing for a very long time, and people are familiar with your writing at Schwartz Media and independently and all over the place. You're on social media regularly covering stuff. You've just started a new piece for Crikey, which we'll mention a bit later on. But I guess the common theme with your writing is that you are someone who, shock horror, maybe takes the Greens seriously, but doesn't always swallow the major party lines on how stupid and ridiculous the Greens are, and I suppose someone who, yes, has engaged with the Greens as a party and is recognizing where they're coming from and will often give the Greens a fair hearing when they're trying to make an argument on certain policy positions. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Are you a Greens spy? Not secret you're a Greens hacker, member?
You're in the you know, can for Big Green or anything like that, but just someone who doesn't immediately wave away to dismiss anything the Greens have to say.
Yeah, look, I mean, I guess... to me, it's important to always note that the Greens are a party that's winning, 10, 11, 12% of the vote, the primary. You know, it may not be reflected in the numbers in Parliament, but that's a third of the primary vote of Labor and the Coalition. Mm. I mean, it's a similar primary vote to the Nats probably. And so, yeah, to dismiss the Greens as like a fringe party or... to suggest that anything that they're doing is being done for reasons of politics. I think that's one thing that always gets, you know, the coverage of the Greens is like, oh, they're doing that for votes. They're doing that for political reasons. Like, we're talking about politicians. They're all in politics. I don't see why the Greens get treated necessarily as people who are constantly doing stunts when, you know, that they have a large constituency and they're representing them in the political system.
Not to be that guy, but I'm looking at the AEC website here. The Nationals get a national primary vote of 3.6%.
Okay.
I guess if you mix in the LNP, the Liberal National Party of Queensland, which is 8%, you know, it's not miles away. But yes, in terms of the rest of the country, outside of fucking crazy Queensland, the Nationals are getting nowhere near the Greens numbers.
I realised with my new piece of work that I'm doing on independents, like crossbenchers and minor independents and minor parties and crossbenchers, is that there are now more crossbenchers in the lower house than there are Nationals. But since having had Andrew G move to the crossbench and Russell Broadbent, there's 18 crossbenchers and there's only 15 Nats. So
does that include LNP? Like, how do you split the LNP?
Yeah,
members?
You can go through and split them up. There are some who sit in the Nationals party room and some who sit in the Liberal party room, and they are, you know, they should split them up to clarify it for all of us, but it's not hard to work out who sits where.
No, we like to make it difficult for you from Queensland. well, maybe we should get into it. Speaking about, you know, the Greens just being interested in doing political stunts, obviously. The big one this week, or what has been accused of being a stunt, is the motion that the Greens moved in federal parliament to recognise Palestine statehood. It was introduced to the House of Representatives on Wednesday, but Parliament rejected the efforts to bring forth a debate on statehood recognition, voting it down 80 votes to 5. Greens leader Adam Bandt said a vote for Palestinian statehood would have been a concrete step towards peace after other countries have also recently recognised Palestine. Now, I mean, I get that this technically was like a vote. It was a procedural motion, right? So it wasn't technically a vote on statehood itself.
Well, it was a procedural motion to suspend standing orders in order to have a vote on recognising Palestinian statehood, which is really splitting hairs. You know, I think a couple of people online were saying, you know, it wasn't actually a vote against Palestinian statehood. Well, if you're voting against the idea of having a vote on Palestinian statehood, you're essentially...
You're endorsing the status quo, which is that we don't recognise Palestinian statehood. So,
the breakdown, we had Andrew Wilkie join the Greens in voting for it, alongside the crossbench voting against it. You had Russell Broadbent, Zoe Daniel, Bob Catter, who I believe tried to suspend the whole vote by claiming that holding the debate at all was anti-Semitic, and then left the chamber for the actual vote. Although I guess came back to vote against it. I don't know. He's a wildcat. He's
Hang
a maverick.
On, yeah.
What the fuck's going on there? Allegra Spender voted against. Andrew G voted against. People who did not vote included a whole bunch of our wonderful friends in the Teals, Zoe Steggall, Haynes, Sharkey, Tink, Dai Lee, Kate Cheney, Scamps, and Monique Ryan as well, all said abstain, did want to weigh in on the whole question as to whether or not we should even have a debate on this motion that was just about recognising Palestinian statehood. What did you make of this whole hoo-ha? Was it just a stunt? We can reasonably assume that it was perhaps never going to get up. It was, you know, a bit of a Hail Mary. It was trying to make a statement and one was using the parliament to say something, I suppose, from the Greens. What did you think of this particular vote and the way it played out, Rachel?
I mean, I think there is an argument to be made that this isn't necessarily the way that statehood is going to be recognised by Australia. And as you mentioned, it was literally no chance of this getting up, especially with the two major parties clearly going to oppose it. But at the same time, when we have a Labor Party that suggests recognising Palestinian statehood, I mean, it's in their national platform.
Yes.
It's something that the Foreign Minister Penny Wong has started floating. It doesn't seem like we're taking any steps towards it. And so therefore what is, I guess you could see as a stunt, and I think some people did see it as a stunt because it had absolutely no chance of getting up, as with many motions that are put to the House of Representatives.
Motions like that happen all the time, for God's sakes. And getting compelling people to get their position on the record and to sort of explain why they don't vote for this stuff.
I think for it to be dismissed as a stunt ignores the fact that there doesn't seem to be any other way for parliamentarians to get on the record saying they support this. Yeah, I guess the question is, like, if the Albanese government has no plans to move towards recognising statehood, I mean, they've said it'll be done when the time is right, but what does that mean? Mm. Well, then what else is there to do other than a quote-unquote stunt? I mean, what's left, really?
Well, yeah, in theory, I mean, the vote like voting down a motion that would enable this debate to happen is perhaps even more worthy of criticism, because it's like, well, at least if you don't think that Australia is ready to recognise statehood, if now's not the time, tell us why not. Like, explain yourself. But no, they don't won't even allow a debate, I think. Is,
right, because if the debate went ahead and there was an actual vote on the question too, then you would
then
also
would
have to
against
have
their
what?
Platform.
Or yes, they'd have to vote against their platform, and you would have, you know, MPs on the record. I mean, as we say, like, not everyone was in the chamber to vote on this particular motion, right? It's not like every single MP had to turn up and state their position one way or the other on the question of Palestinian statehood. True. I mean, there were only what 85. You know, there was 80. It was defeated 80-5 votes. So there's, you know, not even the full parliament's in there to sort of put their position on the record as to where they stand on the question of Palestinian statehood.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's very politician brain to think that the fact that no, we didn't actually vote on the motion, we only voted down
the debate,
the motion to consider
the motion to suspend standing orders in order to put the motion. Like, that may feel like, to some Labor MPs, like, they can say, no, we didn't vote against Palestinian statehood. But to any casual observer or anyone who cares about this issue, well, ultimately that's what happened, and that's how it looks when you see the chamber divide, and you have the Greens and Andrew Wilkie on one side and the major parties and the rest of the crossbench on the other. Mm. I do think it's interesting. I noted that a couple of the Teals were – at first it was that – it appeared they voted against, and then it was the fact that so many of them were abstentions. And, you know, there's excuses going around like, oh, we can't all be in the chamber all the time. But I do note that Allegra Spender and Zoe Daniel managed to be there.
Yes.
And those are – they represent two electorates, We Pledge, Jewish communities. And so those two have been, I would say, of the Teals, the most pro-Israel. Mm. And they managed to be there in order to be there to vote against – the putting of the motion, or the motion, we might as well say. I don't think the fact that, you know, it was short notice or anything is an excuse for anyone to have been absent and therefore to have gotten out of having to have a say one way or the other.
We're very busy parliamentarians. You can't expect us to be in Parliament, for God's sakes, to weigh in on one of the biggest issues facing the world at the moment. I mean, the response from Labor MPs, we had Tim Watts calling it wedge politics, of course, what the Greens were doing here, which, again, shout out to Max Chandler Maoist on X, at Gronk_Gronk, one of my favourite accounts. How do you manage to get wedged on something in your own policy platform, which I think is a pretty good point to make. Yeah. And then you had Monique Ryan, again, she abstained from the vote, and then releasing this insane long statement. Talking about, I agree with Foreign Minister Penny Wong, peace can only be achieved if the Middle East, if Israel and Palestine coexist within agreed borders. The leader of the government moved today that the House of Representatives, the leader of the Greens, rather, moved today that the House of Greens recognize the state of Palestine. This isn't how things work. It's not how you recognize states, blah, 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 blah. I urge all members of the House to stop seeing this unspeakable situation as an opportunity to gain votes. And I mean, this is the really, I think, objectionable response to this idea that.
Yeah.
The Greens are only making any noise about the just cause of recognizing Palestine as a state for their own political domestic ends. They're doing this cruel thing where they're trying to do things that voters will like, that they believe in, that will encourage more people to vote for them because, surprise, surprise, most people believe in the cause of Palestinian solidarity and justice. That's cheating in politics. What you need to do is either equivocate or abstain or back in Israel no matter what to... lose votes, I suppose, or to, you know, to not cause too much fuss, or to not try and be the ire of certain groups, pro-Israel groups, who will take you to task if you do anything that recognises Palestinians' humanity and their oppression and occupation.
Yeah, but I think that immediately claiming the Greens are partaking in wedge politics is sort of what I was talking about at the start. There is this assumption that things that Greens MPs do are for either raising their profile or chipping away at Labor votes in Greens Labor contest. It's like, well, no, maybe actually there are just a bunch of people in those kind of electorates who do believe those things and have the right to have them reflected in Parliament. The one that really gets me, I think, it's a slightly different case, but there is a serious belief among a lot of Labor people that Max Chandler Mathar is obsessed with building his own profile, that he could only be interested in housing for the sake of his own career progression, which is just so baffling, I think, to so many people who are aware of what the housing crisis feels like. But they seem absolutely certain that he could only be doing it for political reasons, and that he only left Labor for the Greens in order for his own, you know, career to take off.
That's so projection. That is so obviously politicians are guided entirely by what's good for their career. That's what we do and live our lives by. So look at this fuck who's getting heaps of media attention by cutting through and getting he's really advancing his career, that bastard. What a loser. What about Fatima Payman that's been going on? Of course, the Labor senator who is, you know, was celebrated the first hijabi wearing woman who's taken on that particular role, who's been under a lot of pressure, I think, and has, you know, finally come out and spoken out, called what Israel is doing a genocide, and has, you know, received the expected political blowback for that. She did post on her X account this poll asking, should Australia recognise the state of Palestine, yes or no? Now,
so she wants there to be a debate.
Pardon? Yeah,
she wants a vote.
She wants a vote on X, I suppose, on X polls. I'm sure that I saw the results of this poll. Maybe they were doctored or something. I'm sure I saw results for like 90% yes or something. Anyway, that still hasn't been closed.
Well, it shows you when you vote, even when it's not over.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. Right. So it's still going. All right. Okay, and the results were still yes, 90% yes today. So obviously, you know, people who are attracted to this particular X are going to weigh in there. Weird that she wouldn't close this poll before the actual political, like parliamentary debate question came up. But anyway, I suppose it's a weird little wrinkle there. But she's now resigned from her position on the Joint Standing Committee and the Legislative Committees on Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade. And people, the coalition particularly, have been calling for her to do that ever since she gave a speech in which she used the phrase, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. I don't know. What do you think about her trajectory, Emerald? People are saying that she should quit Labor and join the Greens, but then I saw an image of her holding up a sign of Max Chalamatha with a thumbs down. So I think
the most recent thing I saw was that, you know, she'd reaffirmed that she wants to stay in the Labor Party. I mean, I'm interested in like Rachel's thoughts as someone who probably has more insight into I just think it's horrible. Yeah, that like your own party wouldn't stand by you in that circumstance. I don't think that they have. And
Didn't. I mean, I think the issue with, especially when she came out and said from the river to the sea, the Prime Minister the week before had condemned that phrase, but he didn't need to. He decided to go along with this sort of misrepresentation, misreading of what that phrase means and condemn it. And then he was kind of stuck when one of his own backbenchers did, and he couldn't come out and defend her or do anything other than condemn her, which he sort of lightly did on radio the next day. I was having a look the other day just at, you know, where she was elected on the ticket in WA. She was third on the Labor Party ticket. Not sure she'd ever get that spot again, but even if she did, it doesn't seem likely that in 6 years' time, Labor would necessarily be picking up three WA senators, which they did in their big WA sweep. So, I mean, we can only imagine her, even if she wants to stay in Labor, her career in Labor and her time as a senator probably won't last much longer than her six-year term. So, I mean, I think I'm curious to see if she decides that becoming an outspoken independent is the way to go and is the way to use the position that she's been elected to, in a similar way to, I suppose, Lydia Thorpe is seeing out her term as an independent and suddenly has a lot more agency and a lot more power as an individual vote in that hung Senate. So I'm very interested in Fatima Payman and what she decides to do here, because she has continued to speak out on what is going on in Gaza and Rafah this week, and she doesn't look like, now that sort of the seal is broken, I suppose she is speaking up constantly. So I don't know how this can really go on and what her long-term future in Labor looks like.
Yeah, it's an interesting comparison to Lydia Thorpe, because I wonder if when it is a question like something so personal as culture and identity that this relates to, and like what sense of responsibility you might feel getting elected to a place where that hasn't been represented, or hasn't, you know, has barely been represented, like what responsibility you would feel to be that representation, even when it comes into conflict with the party, you know, on with which you were elected. So yes, I'll be interested to see as well which way that goes.
But also I get a bit rushed. I know this is not how politics works, whatever, but it's like this should not be a Muslim Jewish issue. Like it should not be someone is a representative of those communities. Like obviously, yes, Fatima Payman has connections to the Muslim community. Obviously, what is happening has particular resonance for the Muslim community. But I mean, this is a fucking genocide, right? This is a foreign policy debate. And every MP, regardless of their ethnic or cultural background, should be looking at the facts and should be taking principled stands on the fact that children are being killed and a nation state that is supposedly our ally that we have a military and political relationship with is committing alleged war crimes. Like, I don't care what your background is. Everyone should be able to recognize what is going on here and speak freely about it and speak up for what's right.
But you're right. That's not how politics works.
No, that's not how it works. Anyway.
I mean,
I'm in the Greens.
But the fact is also that a large number of Labor voters don't necessarily share the official Labor Party line on Israel. And
particularly the membership, right?
Yeah, and yet all MPs and senators are expected to maintain that line because, you know, that's the party's line. So even if the argument that she was elected technically to represent Labor doesn't really wash here, because so many of those voters, those Labor voters in WA would want her to be speaking out and wouldn't approve of what the party's doing.
Very good point.
All right, let's pip through some other stories on this particular front. I know you were interested in the AI meme that certainly did the rounds, Emerald, this all eyes on Rafa thing. I was amazed at how commonly I saw this issue. Yeah. I'm sure people have seen it on their social media feed. What was the deal with this meme and why was it a little bit problematic?
Oh, well, yeah, I don't even know. I don't know that there's that much to say apart from what has already been said, which is that, like, this is an AI image that people are sharing onto their stories. And, yeah, I also would have, like, I would flick through story to story to story and it would just be all that at a certain point. And then people started pointing out, like, there's something particularly off about sharing an AI image as opposed to imagery or even just information about the reality that is happening in Rafah and in Gaza right now, and, like, particularly in the context of a war where Palestinian people have had to, like, go to great lengths to document their experiences and share them in order to be believed. And then what's shared is an AI image. But I also, you know, there's also that thing where it's like maybe we can get too a bit cynical when we are deeply involved and, like, we can recognize that criticism, but maybe also note that this does indicate a strong, like, a broad level of public support for Palestine and a recognition that what is happening in Rafah is, like, horrific.
I mean, it was just, I would say it was just a kind of striking image, I suppose. It was generated by AI, the message of which, when we say all eyes on Gaza, all eyes on Rafah, the call is to say, you know, don't let this fade out of there. Pay attention to what's going on. It doesn't mean just look at this meme and carry on with your day or share this meme.
Sure.
You know, clearly there is an implied idea that you should also keep across what the fuck is going on here and start asking questions. What are you doing? What are your government doing? How are we complicit in this particular action, right? Yeah.
I wonder if, in a way, I know it was, you know, disappointing that people were opting to share the incredibly sanitized, kind of eerie AI image.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, I have to admit, sometimes I see particular images on my feed first thing in the morning and I go to share them and then I sort of pause and think, do I need that to be the first thing someone else sees today? And obviously you don't need to go as sanitized as AI words saying all eyes on Rafah, but I guess for some people maybe the line is way, way further back in terms of what they feel comfortable sharing. I do know that for me, that I'll share a lot of things, but there are sort of graphic images you see that I won't share. And I guess, for so many people who are only just maybe starting to get engaged in this, maybe it's not wanting to necessarily go with beheaded children.
I guess that's, it's like it's kind of giving people an option to express support where they might not otherwise feel comfortable. And obviously there's an argument that like your comfort is irrelevant when this is, you know, in the context of what Palestinians are facing. But yeah, there's got to be a question around, you know, a movement building and organizing in this regard that, yeah, do you do what everyone can get involved in, even if it's not perfect? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point, any support and any interest shouldn't be kind of looked in the mouth. You know, in the last week, I think that the level of interest just from different people I follow on social media, like friends wanting to go to the rally on Sunday for the very first time. Yeah, I just don't think there's also like a good post going around that's sort of something like, hey, even if you haven't spoken before now, even if you sort of didn't really know if you thought this was okay, but you now think it's not, like the best time was yesterday, but the second best time is today. So yeah, not that the AI image was great, but I definitely don't think it's a bad thing that more people shared that. Like the most viewed, like, what was it?
It's got to be record-breaking.
Like, image? I'm not sure what the deal was, but it was some kind of record, shared, right?
Because it's that specific Instagram template thing where you can add your own story. So maybe it's...
Yeah, that's around. Pretty wild. Yeah.
I think we need more pro-Israeli AI images to combat the misinformation on social media. And I'll tell you who agrees with me. Julia fucking Gillard, okay? Oh, she's on board. Her intervention this week, and I looked into this. This is just an Australian article that was reporting on Josh Frydenberg's anti-Semitism documentary on Sky News. So again, this is a beautiful Murdoch media coordination. Frydenberg does a documentary on Sky News, and there's a breaking article which is just quoting Julia Gillard's comments in there. But she has warned that many young Australians have ill-informed and unbalanced views about the Israel-Hamas conflict because social media has exploited their lack of knowledge about the history of Israel. In a rare public intervention from the former Labor Prime Minister, Ms. Gillard says there is a desperate need for better education about the facts of the conflict and the pathways to peace. Now, I read through this whole article. There's not a single specific example cited. I don't know what she thinks young people think. I don't know what she wants to correct. I don't know what part of the history of Israel it's that she really wants to
What are the facts that she thinks are not out there? That
who the fuck knows? And I tell you what, if you really want an inaccurate view of what's going on in Israel, you can listen to the Israeli Defense Force, because the number of things that they've claimed that has been explained to be absolute bullshit, the amount of propaganda the Israel state puts out there via social media and via, you know, pro-Israeli influencers, I would argue that that's distorting people's view, or at least, you know, muddies the conversation about facts and history far more than the actual information that young people happen to be coming across. And it's such a fucking, pro-Zionist, but centrist brain view. The idea is like, wow, all these people who are sort of accessing information directly don't agree with us and are critical of the state that we've been defending for so long. The problem must be the social media and the misinformation. The phones are making these young
kids. It's always
kids
that social media. I mean, it's just like at this point in history, we've got more information at our fingertips than we've ever had, and like Gen Z especially have grown up kind of immersed in all this, and the idea that suddenly like they couldn't possibly be getting the right information when they've got access to like all information in human history.
I mean, like, sure, there's an argument. It's like, yes, the internet is not always a fantastic source of correct information. I'm not gonna pretend that it is, and you know, Google is far more broken than it used to be because it's been turned entirely into an ad machine, and you can't even find what you want on there anymore. But I think it is to me it comes back to the fact that it's like if you can't point to what you think is the misinformation, then I'm suspicious.
Not a single cited. And look, yes,
it's
the internet
interesting
is
that she wasn't challenged on that by Josh Frydenberg. What she might have been talking about.
Yeah.
You know,
for examples.
The misinformation, like young people think that Israel is bad, whereas we all know that it's good. I mean,
yeah, that's right. That's the fact.
These are the facts. But I mean, like, yes, the internet, you know, can be unreliable and does spread misinformation in some ways. Yes, the history surrounding Israel-Palestine. I mean, that is the debate, right? The whole that is where the contestation is. It is a contested history. The certain facts that you look at, or the way that you want to tell that story, is obviously very contested history, and which forms a big part of the, you know, political debates over Israel-Palestine. But I'm sorry, young people accessing facts and being told things directly from Palestinian people, being told an untold history that until now that has challenged the official narrative about this particular state in Israel's history. The fact that people are accessing that and it's making sense to them and they can see with their own goddamn eyes who has more power in this situation and how it's played out. Sorry, Julia, that's your side losing. You need to tell better lies.
I mean, it's so interesting that both those comments from Gillard and we also saw Anthony Albanese a few weeks ago saying that the protesters wouldn't even be able to place Gaza on a map or the river on a map, River Jordan. But, you know, instead of engaging with the fact that they are entirely out of touch with this particular generation that has become especially fired up about this. I mean, it's not just young people, but it's clearly Labor struggling with a particular demographic. Mm. Instead of engaging with them, they're just saying they're wrong. They've got it wrong. Like it's that like
it's the Simpsons
meme of like, am I out of touch? No, it's the children that are wrong. And being so dismissive of them. I mean, do they think that those voters are going to come back to them because they've dismissed them and insulted them?
That they're going to wake up and be like, oh my goodness, what a silly boy I've been. Thanks, Labor. Thanks, Julia Gillard.
Sure.
Maybe, you know, we're coming towards the end of our time together, but maybe we should move on to this other story that I know that you were focused on a little bit and writing about a fair bit, Rachel, and that is the Laura Tingle ABC furor, her comments at the Sydney Writers' Festival, basically claiming or making the perfectly reasonable statement that maybe, just maybe, Australia might be a racist country. This is in the course of the panel discussing, reflecting on Peter Dutton's recent noises about cutting migration intake. She said that Australia is a racist country, let's face it, and the world exploded. Can you explain for folks, you know, as briefly as you can, summarise exactly what went down here?
Well, I mean, the world exploded, but really News Corp exploded. It was the Australian that reported her comments as an exclusive. I mean, can something that she sent to a crowd of people really exclusive? But somebody was there and recording the session, so her comments were splashed in the Australian as Laura's little rant and then, you know, 2GB, the Daily Mail, my favourite journalist, Peter Manonsalin, picked it up. Just like, how dare – it was reminiscent of any time anybody like Ray Martin or Marsha Langton insulted Australians during the voice referendum. It's just how dare you – besmirch the name of Australians. How dare you suggest that they're racist? So this carried on all week until the ABC put out a statement late on Wednesday, sort of standing by her but saying that she had been counselled over her remarks. So basically caving to News Corp's demands to reprimand their most popular journalist over something she said at a writers' festival that was also true, which is that Australia is a racist country. And, yeah, of course, this really is only going to embolden News Corp to do what they do, which is go absolutely savagely mental over comments made by anyone within a stone's throw of the ABC. And I mean, I think the one good thing that's come of this is I think there's been plenty of conversation about the fact Australia is racist. And that is a point that everyone had been dancing around with Peter Dutton's anti-migration push. I think like there was talk of dog whistles and like the AFR even called them like race-tinged comments. But yeah, I think we've actually been able to have conversation that shouldn't really need having, but the is Australia racist? Yes, it is conversation. Yeah, just another classic News Corp beat up, though.
You know, it's kind of like, is Australia a racist country? Well, at least Peter Dutton and the LN, you know, the coalition and probably increasingly Labor have made the calculation that they are. And they're basing their politics on it. So,
yeah. I mean, what is also interesting is like, yes, the parties do seem to acknowledge that. And also, News Corp is running a massive campaign about anti-Semitism being a massive problem. So it's like, but then absolutely furious at someone calling Australia a racist country.
I thought there was, you know,
are we racist or not? Are we, do we have a problem or not? Yeah.
I don't know. I thought it was the ABC's response was like, I read this statement and yeah, it's where you just say kind of almost opposite positions in the one statement and call it a day. And we're saying that, you know, the remarks would not have met editorial standards and that they have counseled her over the remarks, but then being like, also she's a good journalist and has a good history. And I noticed that then only in estimates hearings later in the week was the ABC like, oh, when we said we'd counseled her, it wasn't over her saying that Australia is a racist country. It was around like the lack of context regarding her kind of commenting on Peter Dutton's position more. Like that was my interpretation, which obviously was not clear initially from their response. Their point, if the issue is the comments about Peter Dutton's approach or the coalition's approach, they're also kind of worthy.
But I mean, that is the part that was her job, was to comment on Peter Dutton's approach. That's why she was pointing out that Australia's racist. She wasn't just out there making that point. It was in the comments that were reported, was that she was saying Peter Dutton's migration push is going to encourage people at open for inspections to like harass immigrants or people who look like immigrants. Under Peter Dutton's definition.
Laura Tingle also put out a statement herself, sort of responding to it. I thought her statement was pretty good. It's hard to tell how, the furor was so ridiculous. Like, do you dignify it with a response? Does she have to explain herself? She was saying, in a statement she clarified, she wasn't saying every Australian is a racist, but we clearly have an issue with racism. Yeah. I mean, I think at the heart of it is the perhaps problematic nature of a term, like what does it mean to be a racist country? Like what, when you say that, obviously when you know, a simplistic interpretation of that is everybody in this country is racist, that no person of color can live a decent life in this place, that people are, you know, am I race? I'm Australian, therefore I must be racist. Now I'm not putting much credence to that interpretation, but that's certainly the kind of sentiment that News Corp want to ride on this stuff. Like, look, this person's saying we're a racist country. You live in this country, therefore you're racist. And the racist country means that life is absolute misery for anyone of color.
But I mean,
and that we're evil and racist all the time.
Like that, it's so clear though that like Australia is a racist country doesn't mean all Australians are racist. But the figures at News Corp and in conservative media that get so up in arms about this statement obviously feel a little defensive about the suggestion that they might be racist, that they can't seem to take this, you know, generic and vague comment, but not an actual attack on them. But they are so defensive. And, you know, it's a bit like,
thou dost protest too much. Or
exactly.
Yeah.
My I am not racist t-shirt is probably a lot of questions already answered by my I am not racist t-shirt.
Yeah. And I mean, we've spoken about this on the show before, that it's like, it also comes down to how you define and like perceive racism and whether it is kind of presented as like this individual fault and like you are a racist and that's an unusual condition of like the most horrible people, or whether you have a structural understanding of racism and racism that probably does exist in each of us due to the way that we were socialized, and more importantly probably that it exists and very pervasively in all of the institutions that run Australian society. Like, I think that that's how we would understand racism, but I think it's true that a lot of the people having a negative reaction to this see racism as purely something that individuals are or aren't.
I mean, I really think the answer that you point to there is just like to answer the question of whether the country is like systemically, structurally racist is the outcome of the Voice referendum. I mean, just that's it, really. We had a vote last year and we couldn't do the very simple, generous thing.
We could keep talking to you forever, Rachel Withers, but we have to live our lives. Thank you very much for joining us on Serious Danger. Tell us about briefly, just Forget the Front Bench at Crikey. This is a new weekly column that you've put out there. What are you going to be writing about in Forget the Front Bench?
So it is a weekly profile looking at different important power players on the crossbench and potentially on the backbench. But basically, looking at the fact that we're very likely to have a hung parliament next like a 50% chance is what the latest polls put it at. So who are these people who are going to be holding the balance of power potentially, or holding a balance of power in the Senate now, as the Greens do? So basically just, you know, I've always been very interested in the community independence movement, and hoping to, find out a bit more of what's going on and hopefully, like, point out some candidates that are coming up before they're elected potentially.
What can we learn from the likes of Julia Banks, Cathy McGowan, and their interregnum twins, Rob Urquhart and Tony Windsor? Will the Greens build on their power base? And why does Matt Chandler-Mather drive the PM so absolutely bonkers? These are good questions.
I mean, that last one really has been, it's fascinating.
I hope you're
going
to get to the bottom of that, because if I subscribe to the column and I'm not getting an answer to that, I'm going to be pissed.
We'll get to the bottom of it. Do you know, we did actually almost call the column, we were joking, because I made a reference in the very first column about where the most powerful bottoms in Canberra used to sit on the front bench. And I did suggest to Crikey that we call it Power Bottoms, but we did not call it Power Bottoms.
Sad.
Wasted opportunity there. Thank you for joining us, Rachel Withers. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
In addition to reading Rachel's work and maybe subscribing to Crikey, this week, call to action, please pay the rent for First Nations people. We're at the end of National Reconciliation Week. It includes Sorry Day, which was the anniversary of the Bringing Them Home report being tabled in Parliament. I feel like it's worth saying that there's, you know, some fairly valid criticism of reconciliation as a framing that's been floating around this week that I've definitely seen from, you know, First Nations people and activists kind of being like, Reconciliation Week as a kind of institutional thing is necessarily very sanitized, you know, like government supported and supported by institutions who have no real interest in advancing First Nations justice. But also this idea that, like, what is there to reconcile? You know, I think a feeling of betrayal after the no vote in the referendum, and just like reconciliation not being enough, and more of a fight for sovereignty and for justice. Having said that, it is a good reminder that we should be paying restitutions to First Nations folks as part of the fight for justice. And there are a bunch of organizations that you can, if you have the funds, give money to. We'll put a link in the show notes. That's a good link that I often refer to, but it may be slightly out of date. So actually, if people have other suggestions for good lists of First Nations orgs or causes to support, maybe DM us on the Instagram at seriousdangerau and we can share them there. And the other thing to do this week is the watch and share the Australian Wars documentary on SBS. That was a documentary by Rachel Perkins about the Frontier Wars. Have you watched it, Tom?
I think I've watched half an episode.
Yeah. Well, okay.
I need to put the time in to watch that full thing, because the First Australians, I have seen that documentary series that Rachel Perkins and Blackfella Films did a few years ago, which was fantastic. This one was certainly got a little bit more edge to it, really, or at least more, it was wading into more controversial territory, you might say, in the context of Australia's bullshit history wars about the fact that, no, wars were fought and there was a violent invasion and dispossession of First Nations people. And again, the Australian War Memorial refuses to acknowledge that. Our history books refuse to acknowledge that. It's nonsense. And so learning about that as much as you can is a good thing.
I haven't watched it either, but I think also sharing it is an important point. I don't remember if I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but like I had this conversation with my dad relatively recently that I think must have been about this documentary where I just was like visiting my dad and he's like, "You heard about the Frontier Wars?" And I was like, yeah, what do you mean? He's like, there were wars, you know, like there were real wars fought. Like it wasn't, like there was real kind of battles and there's a whole lot of history there. I've been watching this documentary, so it can make a big difference.
Some people are more, like more interested and invested in the emu wars than they are with the actual frontier wars that were fought of this country. So we could all, everyone, I'm very much including myself in this, we could all afford to learn more about that particular period of history. Yeah.
There's also the Frontier War Stories podcast that Bo Spearum did, or I don't know if he's still doing it. And hey, apart from that, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or if you're listening now. And you can support the show on Patreon for just $3 a month. You get access to a bunch of content, extra bonus content, and it helps keep the show running. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at SeriousDangerAU. Find links and merch and all the other good things at SeriousDangerPod.com. And I don't know. Just be yourself, hey?
Goodbye, everyone.
You are enough. Still doing therapy speak to our listeners. We see you. You hear us, we see you.
It's over.
Serious danger to Australia.